Do we want to start the next chapter?
Sure.
Jyoti, would you like to read?
I read the quotes at the top or just straight onto the paragraph?
Jyoti, I can hear very low volume. Is that
Okay.
so for others?
Is that better?
Little better, yeah.
Okay. I was asking, should I read the first part or just go straight into the text?
Yeah, let's read the quote. We usually read the quotes as well.
Man and the evolution. The one Godhead secret in all being, all pervading, the inner self of all, presiding over all action, witness, conscious knower, and absolute. The one in control over the many who are passive to nature, fashions one seed in many ways. That's the Shveta Swatara Upanishad. The Godhead moves in this field, modifying each web of things separately in many ways. One, he presides over all wounds and natures, himself the womb of all. He is that which brings to ripeness the nature of the being, and he gives to all who have to be matured their result of development and appoints all qualities to their working. That's the same Upanishad. He fashions one form of things in many ways. That's our Upanishad. One who has, sorry, beg your pardon, who has perceived this truth occult that the child gives being to the mothers by the workings of his nature, an offspring from the lap of many waters, he comes forth from them a seer, possessed of his whole law of nature. Manifested, he grows on the lap of their crookednesses and becomes high, beautiful, and glorious. Rig Veda. From the non-being to true being, from the darkness to the light, from death to immortality. Brihadarayanka Upanishad. A spiritual evolution, an evolution of consciousness in matter, in a constant developing self-formation till the form can reveal the indwelling spirit, is then the keynote, the central significant motive of the terrestrial existence. This significance is concealed at the outset by the involution of the spirit, the divine reality, in a dense material in conscience, a veil of inconscience, a veil of insensibility of matter, hides the universal consciousness force that works within it, so that the energy which is the first form the force of creation assumes in the physical universe appears to be itself inconscient and yet does the work of a vast occult intelligence. The obscure, mysterious creatrix ends indeed by delivering the secret consciousness out of its thick and tenebrous prison. For she delivers it slowly, little by little, in minute infinitesimal drops, in thin jets, in small vibrant concretions of energy and substance, of life, of mind, as if that were all she could get out through the crass obstacle, the dull, reluctant medium of an inconscient stuff of existence. At first, she houses herself in forms of matter, which appear to be altogether unconscious, then struggles towards mentality in the guise of living matter, and attains to it imperfectly in the conscious animal. This consciousness is at first rudimentary, mostly a half-subconscious or just conscious instinct. It develops slowly till in more organized forms of living matter, it reaches its climax of intelligence and exceeds itself in man, the thinking animal, who develops into the reasoning mental being, but carries along with him, even at his highest elevation, the mold of original animality, the dead weight of subconscious of body, the downward pull of gravity towards the original inertia and nescience, the control of an inconscient material nature over his conscious evolution, its powerful imitation, its law of difficult development, its immense force for retardation and frustration. This control by the original inconscient over the consciousness emerging from it takes the general shape of a mentality struggling towards knowledge, but itself in what seems to be its fundamental nature and ignorance. Thus hampered and burdened, mental man has still to evolve out of himself the fully conscious being, a divine manhood, or a spiritual and supramental supermanhood, which shall be the next product of the evolution. That transition will mark the passage from the evolution in the ignorance to a greater evolution in the knowledge, founded and proceeded in the light of the superconscious and no longer in the darkness of the ignorance and inconscience.
So, yeah, hereby Sri Aurobindo begins this first of the last phase or lap of the Life Divine, the beginning of a set of six chapters, which are his last chapters, so to say, written very late, you know, some of his really late writings. And so here, as we see, he prefaces this paragraph with a number of quotations from the Upanishads and from the Veda. And in this first paragraph, he is summing up something which he has already laid out in quite great detail so far in the Life Divine. But what we can note from here is, you know, both in terms of the content of the paragraph and the resonance of these various quotations to what is said there, we can note a certain thing that in a way is very important in Sri Aurobindo, and that relates to how he takes his very conscious stand vis-a-vis both Western as well as Indian philosophy. And I'm using the term philosophy not merely as a kind of mental pastime, but as a orientation of being towards experience. You see, the idea of nature is what he is foregrounding over here. In the Western philosophies, nature takes a very important part or plays a very important role through at least one century. That is the century stretching from the end of the 18th to the end of the 19th. Through that century, nature is what replaces God. This is just a little maybe diversion as far as, you know, this group is concerned, but this happens due to, I mean, in philosophical terms, this is what one might call the post-Kantian interlude. It is the period of Romanticism. The German transcendentalists, the English Romantic poets, Wordsworth as one of the greatest of them, Coleridge, later philosophers leading right up to Nietzsche, are all talking in terms of nature as if it is a being. Nature is a secret intelligence that, in a sense, knows, is conscious, is producing the phenomena that have intelligence in them and that also express a certain evolutionary drift to their movement. So this kind of an idea is really a very important part of 19th century European philosophy. It is only in the 20th century that even this gets a blow and to some extent is pushed into the background by an even more materialistic formulation in which consciousness is denied to any kind of universal factor, whether transcendent or natural. So when Sri Aurobindo is using, in Sri Aurobindo's use of language, whether here or in a variety of previous other writings, he is still, to some extent, giving voice, a very powerful voice. He's not the only one, of course, people like Nietzsche have done this continued before him. In philosophy, it is still continuing. To this idea of nature as a cosmic intelligence. Now, of course, as far as Sri Aurobindo is concerned, he's not doing it because it belongs to the West or the history of Western philosophy. But that should not be completely neglected, that factor should not be neglected, because he is talking to the West. Now, on the other hand, he is also taking his notion of nature or a cosmic intelligence in the evolution from the Indian notion of Prakriti. It's Prakriti which is at work in the world, in all things, whether we call it Prakriti or we call it Maya. That is the executive force that we see all around us, creating phenomena. He has many other terms for it also. He calls it active Brahman in certain places. But Sri Aurobindo differentiates himself from both these traditions in making a certain kind of a distinction between a lower Prakriti and a higher Prakriti. Between the intelligence and consciousness of nature and the intelligence and consciousness of the conscious products of nature that can transform nature itself. And he begins with these quotations that to some extent are going to carry a hint of both these things. Both the fact that there is one cosmic force that is at work in all things, and the fact that that cosmic force or consciousness is preparing the birth of something which is more purely conscious and which is ultimately going to transform its own mother. So that's why it may be interesting to take up those quotations in the light of this first paragraph and in the light of this discussion of where Sri Aurobindo's stations, Prakriti, Purusha, and Paraprakriti. In the first one, he says, the one Godhead secret in all beings, all pervading, the inner self of all, presiding over all action, witness, conscious knower, and absolute, the one in control over the many who are passive to nature fashions one seed in many ways. Now, of course, Sri Aurobindo is translating, and it's his own translation. So we have to even look at translation in terms of this cross-cultural dialogue, which all his writing at some level has to be understood as. Passive to nature with a capital N is again a kind of acknowledgement of the philosophy of nature. That is, nature is a cosmic intelligence which has its own reality and its own laws. And all of whatever phenomena and beings we see around us are subject to it. That is why the many are passive to nature. But the many being passive to nature is not the whole of the truth. The whole of the truth is that there is a conscious Purusha in the heart of nature and in each of its entities. That is the one Godhead, secret in all beings, all-pervading, the inner self of all, presiding over all action, conscious knower and absolute. Okay. So he's bringing that in front of our gaze because he's telling us that man in the evolution, he's preluding this man in the evolution, nature, cosmic prakriti, that through the first holocaust of the divine para-prakriti has become the unconscious ground, has sacrificed herself and become this entire cosmos of materiality, of true objectivity, so that out of it, the vehicles may be produced within which Purusha might house himself. But through this entire process, the Antaryami, the conscious controller of the entire process, is the Supreme Purusha at the heart of creation, free from it and yet involved in it. In the second one, he is again going to highlight the same issue in terms of the field, Kshetra, which is again taken up in the Gita. The Godhead moves in this field, modifying each web of things separately in many ways. One, he presides over all wombs and natures. Himself the womb of all, he is that which brings to ripeness the nature of the being. And he gives to all who have to be matured their result of development and appoints all qualities to their workings. Again, he is bringing together Purusha and Prakriti, Ishvara and Shakti, Purushottama and Paraprakriti. The Godhead who moves in the field here is nature, cosmic nature. The Godhead is the Supreme Purusha. But in this, there are these webs of things. Webs of things are each complex of mental, vital, physical existence that is being prepared by nature as a house of habit or habitation of the Lord. Isha Vasyam Midam Sarvam. And this is being modified in many ways. All these varieties of innumerable experiments that are being carried out by the cosmic prakriti and the cosmic purusha, individualized in each case. One, he presides over all wombs. Therefore, this is the one supreme being. He is the womb of all, himself the womb of all. That is, that one is the cosmic nature itself, the nature power, cosmic prakriti itself, and yet he is the one who enters into each of these beings. He presides over all wombs and natures and then brings to ripeness the nature of the being, gives to all who have matured their results of development and appoints all qualities to their working. So Just one. Sorry about that. Subhashta wants to come into the conference. So if somebody, Lopa, if you would, Sham, if you would invite him.
Yeah, I've just done that.
Okay. So that's how he is, bringing together these entities. Prakriti, individual, Purusha, and the supreme status of all these things are one. He fashions one form of things in many ways. Again, the same thing about, the one being that is self-multiplied and evolving through its multiplicity to express its unity. And then the one from the Rig Veda is in some sense the most enigmatic and the most beautiful and challenging, and actually has wonderful symbolic resonances and later writings that I would like to point out. Who has perceived this truth occurred that the child gives being, that the child gives being to the mothers by the workings of his nature? An offspring from the lap of many waters, he comes forth from them, a seer possessed of his whole law of nature. Manifested, he grows in the lap of their crookedness and becomes high, beautiful, and glorious. Now, this wonderful image, of course, we see this as the development of or the evolution of Purusha in Prakriti, both at the cosmic and the individual level. But here it's made so clear that it is the Prakriti, cosmic Prakriti, that produces the vehicle in which Purusha will be born. And Purusha will redeem or transform its own mother. The Prakriti will be redeemed. Now, this transformative power, therefore, it is not. You see, this is exactly where the Veda contains certain truths which are lost over time. And particularly when we think about either nature in the Western sense as a matrix of consciousness, which is wise and which is sending up all the beings and all the phenomena that exist. And when we think about nature as Prakriti in the Sankhyan sense, as the matrix of all phenomena, there is a certain kind of limitation to such an idea. And Sri Aurobindo is distinguishing a certain stand that he is taking from that, which is that cosmic nature serves its purpose when it has created a house or a habitation which is good enough for Purusha to find persistent existence in it, for the psychic being to come into existence. This is also exactly what is meant in the Aitareya Upanishad when the gods look for the creature into which they can all enter. And only when the human appears, they say, truly well-fashioned, and enter into him. Now, this entry of the persistent person, not just a psychic entity, but the psychic being, into a house of nature, a house of cosmic nature, presages an entirely new movement to the evolution. A movement in which nature, it's almost like a triple-staged rocket in which the first stage has served its purpose. But it will not be discarded. It will now be transformed by that which it has served. See? So this child will now, that's why the first sentence so beautifully stated in the form of a question, to evoke the wonder of this reality. Who has perceived this truth occult, that the child gives being to the mothers by the workings of his nature? Now, the other thing interesting here is that the mothers, the plural, and then again in the next sentence, an offspring from the lap of many waters, he comes forth from them, a seer possessed of his whole law of nature. Now, these many mothers, many waters, these have been given their name in ancient Indian Shakti practice as the Saptamatrika. The Saptamatrika are the seven mothers. These seven mothers correspond to the seven layers of manifestation. Each one of them with their own power or potency, their own quality, that ultimately is integrated in the Purushottama. So to give birth to the Purushottama, these seven mothers suckle the divine child. And this beautiful little passage from the Rig Veda is actually given symbolic form much later in the Puranas through the myth of Skanda or Kartikeya. The Kriptikas are those mothers who suckle the divine child who will be born to them as if tossed into their midst from the transcendent. And that redeems nature. That is the one that ultimately will transform the ignorance and the falsehood which belong to cosmic nature, which cosmic nature cannot overcome by itself, because it is through this birth that that will happen. So in a sense, this is the prelude, and this is in a way Sri Aurobindo is giving us a gist of man in the evolution, that nature prepares the birth of Purusha, but Purusha is subject to the ignorance and falsehood of nature, but has the seed in it of overcoming it, because ultimately it is one with the original power that is indeed the transformation and the uniting power.
Beautiful, really beautiful. Thank you. I was thinking of this Wordsworth that you mentioned as a romantic poet. I read a long back a poem of his, and that is called We Are Seven. It's a long one, and it is definitely primarily based on nature. A rustic girl, and you know, the curly hair and all that. However, the most significant point of that poem was that her innocence of death. She does not know what death is. So though two of her siblings died and they're in grave, but for her they exist all the same. So they're still seven, they're not five. And the poet tried to convince her, but still could not. So this part was quite interesting. I just wanted to, you know, I don't know whether it is relevant, but then I see it as that innocence as a kind of knowledge, not really an ignorance. Whether that was the intention of the poet or not, that I don't know, but it was very visibly projected. That's one thing. And another thing I was thinking of is that this about again that the single thread of harmony growing from knowledge to knowledge instead of ignorance to knowledge. That was the discussion that we were having before this reading. there during this talk of yours, I was thinking that this today, no matter how much we think that all the knowledge that we are gaining out of life is knowing ourselves, but still we feel that there is something unknown that is other than the self. Like, I'm knowing myself fine, but there is also an other nature. I mean, some Shakti or some, you know, some kind of power outside of me, which is also I am knowing. Whereas when we go, when we conquer nature, when we master nature and grow from knowledge to knowledge, there it could be that that knowing self is the only knowing. Like this knowing something other than self no longer exists. So there will still be unknown in the exploration of the self, but it will be completely conscious of the fact that it is nothing but the self that we are knowing or becoming. If that makes at all any sense to you. So anyway, the Wordsworth and this one I wanted to bring up.
Yeah, undoubtedly. I think, yes, you see, what you said about Wordsworth, I recollect that poem. I don't remember very clearly now the entire poem and its drift, but yes, I do remember it is about siblings and the fact that a number of them die. And then, you know, he has a whole set of poems of a similar nature. And I don't know whether it is this particular poem or not, but you're very right about the fact that this innocence of childhood, this we are seven, she continues to see this as a life, as a living being. This innocence puts her in contact with the cosmic consciousness. And actually, I don't know whether it's in this poem or another one. I think it's another one where he has a line of a similar kind of idea, which Sri Aurobindo quotes in the Future Poetry as one of, and Sri Aurobindo treats the Wordsworth as one of the very highest poets who has expressed the overmind in a number of his lines. And this is one of them. And it's actually, he quotes it as an example of Wordsworth's contact with this cosmic consciousness in nature. And he's talking about somebody who has died. I think it's one of the Lucy poems. And the line goes, rolled round in earth's diurnal course with rocks and stones and trees. So she has become one with nature, and she is part of the cosmic cycle of nature, rolled round, rolling inside, just as if part of nature, earth's diurnal course with rocks and stones and trees. And he quotes this line as one showing how in his inner consciousness he experienced the actual movement of that cosmic power, cosmic Shakti. So yes, I wanted to make note of that Sri Aurobindo actually gives a very high place to that experience of nature as a cosmic reality, as a cosmic conscious, kind of cosmic consciousness, and the ability to contact it that in the history of Western philosophy and poetry was achieved to some extent. And secondly, as far as what you were saying, that the second point about would you repeat that second point? I think I'm kind of forgetting a little bit about it. Just in sure. Short.
Sure. It's about that from this play of forces progressing towards that single thread of harmony and that how that progress really would look like. I was having a thought about like that today no matter how much I say that, okay, my
yes,
life
yes,
is not
I remembered.
Myself.
I remembered, yes. So, yes, what struck me over there is, again, this very great importance that the Upanishads give to the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. These three forms of being in our consciousness, that we have to have a relationship with each of these three. We have a relation with the domain of the known, which is a relation of arranging, organizing, of putting the field in order, of ordering the field. We have a relation with the unknown in exploring, in opening up, in expanding, in adapting, in growing, etc. But even more important is to have a constant relation with the unknowable. And that constant relation with the unknowable is the openness to the unpredictable, and that which will interrupt the order of the cosmos constantly and unknowably from the supreme, from the transcendent. So that thread, that is the ultimate, the yajna, the truth of yajna, which is the truth of surrender. Basically, the backbone of existence has to be the surrender to the unknowable, that which can never be known. As, you know, the primary reality around which the unknown and the known form the two other aspects of our own reality.
Debashista, when you mentioned the seven mothers, the Sapta Matrika,
that's cute, it's something else. Sorry about that, we are back.
Sure.
Yeah, Debashita, I was saying, when you talked about the Sapta Matrika,
yes.
I suppose you referred to them being the seven Matrikas of Devi Mahatmyam, right? Aindri, Maheshwari, Brahmani, and those seven.
Yes.
And are they, I didn't know that they were also representative of the seven layers of the being, like physical, vital, mental. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. They are the seven shaktis,
mm-hmm,
of the seven layers of the manifestation.
Okay. That part, where is, I mean, there must be some more literature than just Devi Mahatmyam that talks about the Sapta Matrika. Is that right?
Yes, there is. I can look into it. Somebody I know, you know, from Los Angeles has done her PhD on this, on the Sapta Matrika. Kathy Harper, and so I can look into what are the texts that carry more detail about this particular aspect.
Mm-hmm. And those, the Kritikas, the mothers of Kartikeya,
yes,
are they also connect, I mean, you said they are, but in the literature they also refer to those seven powers or seven shaktis of the layers of the being?
Yeah, that is my intuition.
And they are in the Vedas, they are also related to the seven rivers.
Yes.
Okay? Saraswati being one of them.
Sapta Nadya, yeah.
Like Brahmani, Saraswati, I see.
Yes.
Somehow I thought river was representative of consciousness.
Yeah, it's Shakti, Shakti. Uh-huh. So each one of them is a form of Shakti.
Just to clarify further, so the Saptamatrikas are, they correspond to the seven people planes of Sat, Chit, Ananda, Supermind, Mind, Life, Matter?
Now, my sense is that that is what they are originally meant to be, though it's difficult to tell if you actually study these, the phenomena, the entire history of the worship of Saptamatrika, for example. Then it is also possible that, you see, what happens in the tantras is that a lot of folk ritual and a lot of, aboriginal worship becomes formulated in terms of Vedic and Vedantic realities. There is a dialogue going on. You see, to what extent it is original and to what extent there has been a translation and a transformation is difficult to tell. So I am not that much expert in knowing, where this connection can be found or whether there is a one-to-one connection. Whether originally each of these names of the Saptamatrikas was related to one of these seven planes that we are talking about. But definitely in its development, you see these seven mothers related to these, basically these seven, and also they become related to the seven chakras. Now, which is more important in which practice is difficult to tell.
Okay, thank you. I was just wondering about that. There is one more phrase that I'd like to point out here, just to have you shed some light. This is the Rig Veda passage, where he's saying that the child gives being to the mothers by the workings of his nature.
Yes.
Now, the child, I understand from you, is the Purushottama. And his nature is, of course, not the qualities that we are subject to, not the gunas. But his nature is that quality of the witness, conscious knower, the absolute.
Yes.
Right? And then the more puzzling part is that last sentence where he says, manifested, he grows.
Yes.
In the lap of the crookednesses and becomes high, beautiful, and glorious. I'm just stumbling a bit over that verb grows, because in some sense to me that the Purusha is always that absolute conscious knower within us. How does it grow?
Yes, I think here the child, and that's why the term child is being used, it is the archetypal psychic being. What in the life divine, in the first part of the life divine, he'll call the divine soul. Now, the divine soul is the archetypal psychic being. It's not the Purushottama in the sense of the Supreme Lord or Supreme Being as the Lord of all things, but as that which will become the psychic being born to the cosmic mother in all her individual formations. See? So that is what grows. The psychic being does grow. It is what evolves. And so it's that presence of the Purushottama as the psychic being, as the divine soul, that is being referred to over here. And the nature that is being talked to by the workings of his nature that you referred to has to do with the psychic nature. The psychic nature that transforms the cosmic nature. The mothers over here are referring more to the manifestation of these cosmic, these seven powers in the cosmic nature. So in the cosmic nature, these powers are subjected to ignorance and bound by ignorance. That is, and it's, that's why he uses, the Veda uses the term in the lap of their crookedness. Because just like the triple soul forces in Savitri, the goddesses over there, though they take their origin in the supreme planes, they are constrained by the powers of the avidya. So here too, the mothers, these Saptamatrika, they are constrained by the powers of avidya. And yet they give birth to the divine soul, the psychic being, that by its workings, the working of its nature, can transform those cosmic energies.
Thank you. That's a very interesting passage. I guess it's one of those passages that hints at evolution in the Rig Veda.
Yes, it does. Yeah, I would agree that it does hint at evolution. In fact, that's the thing. That in retrospect, when one applies Sri Aurobindo, one finds the perfect fit, how it explains perfectly a lot of these things which otherwise are so difficult to understand. And every explanation that would be given to something like this would not touch the point, or it would touch some aspects and miss out the others. But when you look at it from that point of view, the Sri Aurobindo's point of view, every little detail fits perfectly.
Thank you so much, Devashish.
I want to add that I also felt that in reading many of the things earlier, you always feel there's a forced interpretation or a forced putting into place, which kind of eases out when seen in the light of Sri Aurobindo.
Yeah, yes, absolutely true.
Recently in a Veda class, I was told that there is no individualization in Veda. Everything is presented in terms of universal facts or events. So if that is the case, then here that psychic being that you were referring to, I was wondering whether that is the true statement or not. I mean, what I was told, whether that is true or not. Maybe there is individualization.
From this particular verse, it would seem, and Sri Aurobindo's placing of it in this particular chapter, it would seem that certainly he is holding the view that there is an idea of the psychic being and the individualization of the divine, soul in nature, and its evolution for that matter.
Even if we don't take the psychic being or individualization, in other words, even then, can it be said that the cosmic being itself is growing? Because in manifestation, it is God is knowing himself, and that is the whole meaning of manifestation.
Yeah, certainly it can be said, but you see the use of that image, the metaphor of the child, see, with a capital C, points towards a much more cogent understanding if we think of it in terms of all the sort of the psychic being and the growth of the psychic being in individual cases. Now, if we take it as the divine reality that is being born in cosmic nature and all things are all around us and growing. So it's like a cosmic evolution. The cosmic evolution of the Purusha. Still, if the cosmic evolution of the Purusha is being aided by the Prakriti, it comes together, all the seven rivers, as it were, nurturing one being, really comes together, that integral being, that integral Purusha, comes together only at the human level, where it becomes individualized. Now, you may say the only possibility of treating it as a non-individual reality is if we say that this entire passage is about human evolution in a general sense. That instead of talking about each human being, if we take the whole of humanity as this child, then it's possible to say that it is not non-individual.
Devashisa, this mundane question about the Vedas, is it true that a lot of the Vedas are not there anymore?
Surely. I mean, that Sri Aurobindo holds that view.
In that case, it is very difficult to comment on the Veda saying that it is individual or not, because we haven't seen the rest.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, in fact, according to Sri Aurobindo, the whole Savitri legend is coming out of the Veda, and it is not there now. And you know, the variety of things, yes, certainly it's very difficult to say anything about the Veda in a conclusive way because, you know, Sri Aurobindo holds that a large amount of the Veda is lost. You know, what we have right now is only, and you know, what we call the person we call Veda Vyasa has managed to, you know, sort of retain from an earlier period when there was much more of it.
I also like the point you made earlier about how, you know, you can never translate one language fully into the other. All you can do is enter into a dialogue with another language, another culture. And I think that's true of the Vedic Sanskrit. I mean, it's really difficult or almost unimaginable to entered their consciousness, so the way they structured the language and the way they came up with this literature.
Yes, true. I wanted to make another comment about that Saptamatrika, that, you know, in the sense that, I mean, in tantric, sort of old Saptamatrika, by the way, was in terms of Indian practice, was very early practice, much earlier than Durga, etc., who become more important later. So Saptamatrika existed, and we have, you know, representations of Saptamatrika much before many of the other goddesses become important. And we don't know whether they had the same names as are given to them later. But this is interesting in that early representations of Saptamatrika have got two Purushas at two ends. At the higher end, or at the you know, I mean, at the first, you know, there is Maheshwari, and next to her is Shiva. And at the bottom, or at the last, after the seventh, and I'm not sure what the seventh, you know, is in all these cases, there is Ganesha. So Shiva and Ganesha are the two, you know, beings who form the two Purusha entities at the two ends. And Ganesha is considered to be close to the material, in other words, matter, the presiding power of consciousness, or Purusha of consciousness in matter is considered to be Ganesha, and that in spirit is considered to be Shiva in this system.
So it's about 9:40. So there was just the shall we continue, stop here and continue next week?
Yes, undoubtedly, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, let's stop with a brief
Thank you.
meditation.